Hello?
Mr. Wallace.
Hey, man.
So, I guess we're diving right in here. You had the topic this week that you wanted to discuss.
Yeah, the topic I want to discuss this week actually is a couple, but mindsets and that student mindset for their learning and education. I kind of wanted to talk about a little bit along with how to change mindsets from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset, which we'll explain what that is a little later on if my partner has read any of the book.
I have not, so you're going to have to dive into it, but that's okay because I've studied this before, specifically from an author named Angela Duckworth, who wrote a book called Grit, and it talks about having kind of a resilience mindset is, I believe, the word that she uses. In other words, believing that you have the ability to change. Is that correct?
It is. And specifically when it deals with education, we're looking at things like I'm smart as being a static mindset, or I'm not smart as being a static mindset. And, you know, what that looks like and what those kind of mindsets lead to. And people, for example, if I say I'm smart, then I'm going to feel bad if I do horrible on something, or if other people start looking at me as I'm not smart anymore. And so I may not take as big of risks as I would have, or try to tackle more difficult material than I would have had I not already labeled myself as being smart.
Got it. So, that's interesting. Is it saying that people? Well, first of all, let's handle this. Besides the mindset point, is it true? Can people have a certain IQ or whatever we use to measure intelligence and lose that or gain more?
That's the research, and it's coming out of Stanford University, so I tend to kind of believe it for now.
Yeah.
You know, it's a reputable university that I'm sure most of the listeners have heard of before. But the thing about it is they're saying that education or intelligence is really something that is plastic. It's more like flexible. So, for example, there's a thing in London. There's an exam that these taxi cab drivers have to take, and they have to know every street in London from memory, not from, you know, not GPS, not looking anything up, not, oh yeah, and I kind of know how to get there. They take a written exam on every street in London, which London is huge, and every little tiny street is crazy. And so what they noticed was there's a certain part of the brain that actually grows when they're taking this test and they're studying for this test. And so they're thinking about that, you know, because you've always heard so many people say, well, I'm a math person, or I'm not a math person, or yeah, I'm not really an English person.
Right.
And the kind of thinking that's out there now in the cognitive science field is that there are no such things as a math person or an English person. If you put in the time and you study it and you work at it, you'll get better at it like anything else. And there's no inherent, you know, math aptitude as much as there is, you know, some people pick things up a little quicker, just in general. Some people process things a little faster, just in general. But they're finding that those aren't necessarily linked with specific subjects. And if you're bad at a subject, you can become better. And those students who realize that, instead of thinking, oh, I'm just not a math person, if they realize, no, I can work harder and get better at it, they actually find that they're working harder and getting better at it. And you know, we celebrate failure as much as we celebrate success, because you learn during failure, and it kind of changes that learning process for people.
Would it be fair to say, not to take this to an extreme, but sure, it's kind of summarized in the phrase, if you believe, it's possible.
Right.
It is. Yeah. And I've heard the study of the taxi cab drivers before. And what was fascinating to me in reading that study was that those cab drivers, when they studied their brains, they had enlarged hippocampus.
That's correct. Yep.
Yeah. So their brain, and it wasn't that they were born with large hippocampuses and then put into taxi cab school because of that.
Right.
They're just normal guys, and their brain adapted to the apparently super complicated road system that is London.
Right.
It's fascinating stuff. I love it. The study that the brain can change itself is neuroplasticity.
Sure.
Yeah. So as a teacher, let's say that you see someone, like I'm a Spanish teacher. So let's say somebody comes to me and says, Spanish just isn't my thing. What do I do with that? And is that true? And because some people, just based off of the paths they've chosen since they were younger, Spanish might not be their thing at the moment. Like, languages typically coincide with people who are strong in math and music. And so maybe just based off of that child's road that they followed up to then, Spanish would not be something that they're strong at. So what are the first steps to convincing a student that, no, you can do this?
Well, part of the problem is not necessarily trying to convince them they can do it, but the 11 years of teachers that just went along with, yeah, this might not be your thing. Maybe this other thing is your thing.
Yeah.
You know, so you're really starting from scratch, having to talk to people and say, hey, I could get like, you don't like it. Like, I understand, hey, I just don't like that. But studies have found that if you start becoming better at something, you start to like it more.
That's true.
And so, you know, so talking to them, like I'm kind of new to this whole growth mindset versus static mindset thing. So I haven't tried to experiment with this any in class. That'll be a fall thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, our job is to, like we've talked about before, make the learning the thing and not the grades.
Right.
You know, let them know that everybody can learn something new, that there's no such thing as I'm bad at this. It's I need to work on it and I can get better at it.
So let's talk about a failure, for example. You mentioned that people need to rejoice in failure.
Correct.
or use failure as a benefit. So what does that look like? Give me an example.
Well, the studies show that, and nobody really knows exactly why this is true, but if you're working on something, and I'm going to use math for an example, and you do the problem wrong, you actually do more for your brain and grow pathways in your brain. It's better than if you just pull it out of memory and get it right.
Okay.
And so making these mistakes and embracing that is really kind of the direction we should push them into. Because we celebrate 100s and we celebrate, you know, the people that make these high A's. And really, if they're instantly learning it, then they're not really shaping their brain as much as the people who have to struggle and make the mistakes and get there. And I'm not saying that, you know, oh, the person that made 100 didn't learn anything. Well, that's kind of at that point when we're doing the summative assessment, we're not checking for their learning. We're checking to see if they've already learned it. But we need to encourage them to make mistakes and fail in class. When I was in college, there was another student in there. We'll call her, I mean, her first name's Sarah. We'll call her Sarah because I don't know that Sarah is going to be listening to this podcast.
Right.
She's working on a PhD at Rutgers. And even if she is, hi, Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
How have you been?
The listener.
yeah. We were in advanced calculus, which is past Calc 3. Other colleges call it real analysis. And I would ask, I don't want to say stupid questions, but I'm the king of stupid questions in class. Like I would, my first month or first couple weeks in a class, I ask all my questions and some other students get annoyed with it a little bit. And, you know, sometimes I could tell Sarah would get a little annoyed with some of the trivial questions that I would ask.
Right.
And test time would come and I'd make like 142, like beat the test out the park. And finally, a friend of mine, Aaron Smith, you know, had asked me, because I was keeping up with him, and he's like, Daniel, you ask the stupidest questions in class, and you're always asking these questions. But then when you get to the test, you're making these high grades. And I'm like, well, yeah, because I get all my stupid questions out and I learn before I get to the test.
Yeah.
Right. So I get all my failure out because I have no qualms with looking like an idiot in front of everybody.
Right.
And I would do it all the time and just get all of my dumb questions and all the things that were messed up in my head out of the way. And then when the test would come, I'd kill the test. And so one day Sarah asked a question, and our professor, Dr. Manassi Ephraim, still a good friend of mine. I consider him a good friend. He may be listening to this one day and be like, we're not friends. I don't know what he's talking about. But I consider the guy a good friend.
Yeah.
And, you know, he just shut her down. He's like, no, that's you know, ridiculous. That's not a thing. And she looked really, really sad. And I was like, you know, Sarah, do you not like being wrong? And she's like, well, who likes being wrong? And yeah. I'm like, I like being wrong because that's how I learn. If I just walk around with all these wrong things in my head, then when the test comes, I fail. You right. know, it doesn't do anything for me. So I'd rather struggle with it, ask the stupid questions, make the stupid mistakes, and learn from it and fail the whole way up until what counts, and then be able to, you know, use all that trial and error, I guess you could say, as the basis for scoring really well in the test later.
Right. Yeah, that's something that's hard to convince students about. And this happens not only in the classroom, it happens with my own children. And my son Pablo, he's 6, he's doing phenomenally better in this area, and I can't really take any credit for it. But when Pablo used to mess up, he would get so angry and just give up. Like, whether it was in we would go outside and play soccer together, and if I scored a goal on him, whether he was winning by 20 points or something, if I scored one goal on him, he would sit down and give up and stop and be like, I'm terrible at this. I should stop playing. He's gotten better. Like, we were learning how to tie shoes recently, and he kept messing up, but he got closer and closer. And I don't know if my response to him had anything to do with it. Like I would say, hey, you're close. Hey, you're even closer. Hey, you're doing great. But he finally got it and was happy. But, you know, before, he would have just given up. I honestly don't know where the change happened. Go ahead.
I think a lot of it, you know, is society. Do you remember Mike Tyson and his fighting career?
I don't remember much. I do know who Mike Tyson, but I don't remember much about his fighting career.
Do you know who beat him finally?
No, I don't.
So there's a guy named Buster Douglas.
Yeah.
Who is famous for beating him.
Okay.
And to this day, I remember Buster Douglas beat Mike Tyson.
Right.
But I don't know all the people who Mike Tyson beat.
Oh, interesting.
So, you know, he was this pinnacle smart person. And all we remember, really, a lot of us who maybe not have exactly followed his career, but, you know, were around then, kind of watched a little bit of boxing, we all remember Buster Douglas beat him.
Yeah.
We all remember who made him look stupid.
Right. He was the champ. He was the champion, but he got beat, and so he's of little significance now.
Right. And so you think of the smart people, and, you know, they're making hundreds in all the tests, and then they fail one, and everybody remembers that.
Right.
And the smart people are thinking, wait a minute, I'm smart. I don't want to feel like this. I'm not, you know, they have that fixed mindset that they are smart and they can't fail.
It's like that student that I have who gets mad when she gets a 98.
Yeah.
And not a 100.
And we shouldn't be worried about grades anyway.
Right. I know. Know what? This is happening to me in my Spanish classes. So we're getting ready for the exam. One of the pieces of the exam is the kids have to get on computers and use this verb conjugation program.
Right.
And so I'm having them practice every day to get ready for this. And it's funny because they'll raise their hand. They still have 2 weeks to go before exams at the time of we're recording this. And they'll raise their hand and they'll say, Hey, profe, today my grade was a 55. And I'll look at them and I'll be like, great, good job. And they'll look at me like really odd, like, what? Like, that's terrible. And others will raise their hand, profe, I got like a 72. Hey, that's awesome, good job.
Right.
And in their mind, they see that grade and they're thinking, this is it, I'm done. This is what I'm going to get on the exam. In my mind, I'm thinking, wait, you didn't get a zero and you're halfway there? You have 2 more weeks to go. You're doing great.
Right.
Like, it's, but it's funny. One of the students this past week, I really got on to them. Probably not the best way, but I just got sick of it. But one of the students raised their hand and had his closed his computer basically and said, I'm done. And I'm like, what do you mean you're done? He's like, I'm going to fail this exam. I'm like, you still have 2 weeks to go. And he's like, yeah, I'm done. And then I finally just, because when someone has that, and this is kind of my next question, when someone has that mindset that they're going to fail, how do you pull them out of that? And for me, it was just, okay, you're going to fail. I was like, that's fine. Go ahead and give up. And I'd built enough rapport with this student that me getting angry at him actually didn't affect him. He came back to me later and was like, I needed to hear that. But I basically told him, if you want to go ahead and give up, just give up. It's fine. And yeah, it's of little significance to me because it's your grade. This exam's 20% of your grade. And if you want to give up, go ahead, lay your head down on your desk and give up.
Right.
yeah, I said it.
Good job.
I was pretty upset actually.
Good job.
But he received it well, but how do you pull students out of that? Like out of that, oh, I'm going to fail mindset.
So there's a teacher I started to follow on Twitter, and she has a website that I don't know off the top of my head, and I should have been a little more prepared.
Yeah.
But, you know, being a teacher, we should actually prepare for things, which we really don't do.
No.
So one of the things I like what they're doing is they only celebrate the mistakes.
Oh, interesting.
They only bring people to the board who have it wrong. And they celebrate those wrong things. And they talk about the, you know, the beautiful way that that person was thinking and the different things that they can change now that they know the difference. And it's all about the mistakes in class. It's all, that's what's celebrated. They celebrate all that. They don't talk about the things that everybody got right. They kind of brush over all the things that were done, you know, well, and kind of harp on, you know, you're learning. This is a good way to learn. Let's talk about these mistakes. Let's look at the best mistakes. Let's look at, and there are, you know, better mistakes than other mistakes. Some mistakes are bad mistakes and some mistakes are good mistakes.
Right. Well, and I think it was interesting that you would say that you said earlier that failure and mistakes are the way that people are actually learn better.
Right.
I remember experiencing that in school where if I was in the classroom, it was specifically with math, but it wasn't in the classroom that I learned the best. It was when I go home and I would actually look up the answer in the back of the book, because they have the answers in the back of the book.
Right.
And I would struggle to get that answer, and I would fail and I would fail and I would fail. But once I got the right answer, I'd failed so many times. I knew all the mistakes that somebody and all the traps somebody could make. So I would come in the next day knowing the material better than other people because I knew the mistakes that you could make and traps you'd fall.
It's funny that you mentioned it that way because I got in trouble one time. I'm not going to say where or why, but I gave a test in Algebra 2.
Yep.
And I put all the answers on the board.
Right.
Because it doesn't matter. Like, I want to know, how do you get to those answers? And I wanted the student to relieve the pressure of, you know, I know what the answer is. I just need to know how to get there. And so if, you know, 4 times 3 becomes 37 for some reason, I can catch those silly mistakes, but I could make it to the end of the process. Like, you know, if we're doing the quadratic equation, and I give you the answer is -3 + or - i√2/6.
Right.
If you a polynomial, it's not obvious if you don't know the quadratic formula how you got there.
Right.
So my thinking was I'll give them all the answers and let them work through the test. And the person above me, who might have been a little not on board with that, thought that that was not as rigorous as not giving them the answers. And right. I had a parent who was like, well, if you're just going to give them all the answers to the tests, my student doesn't need to go there anymore.
Oh, no.
So some of these things, I don't want to say the problem with it, is we're used to math and some subjects looking the way they do now. And parents remember what they looked like 30 years ago. And parents remember either hating it or liking it. And administrators and teachers who've been doing this for 20, 30 years, you know, we do it because we've done it. And that's the way we've always done it. And so some of these new ideas come under fire because people don't understand, like not giving homework.
Right. Yeah. But it's the methods that we keep using that are not working for us. Where'd I read about this earlier? The methods we're using now came out of the industrial age, not right. the information age.
Correct.
And so we've got to start changing some of this stuff. And the failure, so again, this podcast topic isn't about failure. It's a piece of the growth mindset, sure. But it's how you interpret failure that kind of decides if you're growing or not.
Right.
Interesting. Another discipline this applies to is chess. I'm still playing chess. You got me. Yeah, you got me hooked on chess.
Good.
What was it, like 3 years ago, 2 years ago?
Yeah, that means you should be able to beat me now, right? Because you have 3 more years
right.
of practicing chess.
Nice try. yeah, I'm still no good. But I have gotten a lot better. And one of the reasons that I get better is because I failed so much. And I remember coming to you the first, because you had me download this chess app.
Right.
And I remember coming to you after 2 weeks and being like, I haven't won a game yet. And being so frustrated. But just, it takes time. But I do have a question. So there's a right way to interpret failure and a wrong way. So let's use a historical figure as an example. Apparently, Benjamin Franklin stunk at chess.
Okay.
He was better than the average person because he played a lot.
Right.
But he was never to the point that he wanted to be. But when looked at his patterns of practice based on failure, he would just play over and over and over again and fail over and over and over again. Apparently, there's something that he should have been doing differently that would have increased his ability to win. It was like he wasn't doing anything with the failure. He would just try again.
Right.
It's kind of like the phrase, if at first you don't succeed, try again. Well, no, there's more to the story. So right. what do you think that more to the story is?
Well, you know, everybody says practice makes perfect, but I think perfect practice makes perfect.
You know,
if you practice it the wrong way, you're just going to get better at the wrong way. It's like when veteran teachers tell me, oh, that's never going to work. I've been doing this for 20 years. And I tell them, you know, just because you've done it wrong for 20 years doesn't mean that it automatically makes it better.
Right.
So I really think, like, you know, if somebody went through and just did polynomials, for example, because again, everything in my world is math.
Yeah.
If they did polynomials and kept getting them wrong and kept getting them wrong, I think they're going to continue to get them wrong. But if you get them wrong and then you figure out your mistake and you analyze, like I have software that analyzes my chess matches and tells me where I stink. And so, you know, if you analyze your mistakes and you see what you did wrong and you grow from those, that's what the growth mindset, right? We're trying to, every time we mess up, we're trying to see what we did wrong and grow a little bit from that so we don't do that again. Then that's really where you're taking the time to kind of try to fix your problems, because just failing is failing, you know?
Right. It's kind of like, what do you value that fail? Right. Like, instead of taking the failure and saying, oh, I failed, well, I'll just forget about that and be positive and try again. It's actually seeing the failure as a gift.
Right.
And unpacking that gift and being like, what can I learn from this failure that I will do differently next time?
Yeah, and I think, and I don't know how it is with Spanish, but with math, there's good failure and bad failure. For example, again, if I'm teaching polynomials and you're multiplying two trinomials, which I don't know if the listener is going to be able to visualize this in their head, but let's just say you're, you know, at the beach and you have 20 minutes free time and you break out your polynomials book and you decide that you're going to multiply two trinomials. So you multiply your trinomials and you mess up, not because you didn't know how to do it, not because the distributive property failed you, but because you were sloppy in your work and didn't line things up and combine things right. That's a bad failure.
Right.
Right. Because that's a bad mistake. Just because you're being lazy and sloppy, you know, those mistakes are bad mistakes. But if you're looking at it and you don't do the distributive property correctly, you distribute wrong, and then you look back at it, that's a good failure. Like, you didn't quite catch the distributive property concept and you were using it wrong, and then somebody fixes that for you and you use it right, then you're going to get it right. But if you're just sloppy every time and making those kind of mistakes, those aren't really growth mistakes. You just got to organize your crap and don't be lazy.
Yeah. And there's a book called Peak. And it's basically a book that studies practice and intentional practice. And that's kind of the phrase that is used, is failure's fine, but you have to take the failure, use intentional practice, get feedback from experts or from somebody else, and then go about things a different way.
Right.
And one of the key components there is getting an expert to explain to you where you went wrong. And I feel like that's something that I need to do in the classroom a little more, is tell students, hey, if you're not understanding this, come find me at lunch. Because I typically just assume that they will. Right. And I'm kind of thinking now, no, this generation, well, any generation, but this generation might not have that piece of common sense that says, oh, I don't understand this, maybe I should go to the teacher.
Right. And well, a lot of them are battling really bad things anyway. So, for example, my students are in high school, have one in eighth grade about to go in high school, and then another one in middle school and one in elementary school. And my daughter brought home her work and was, you know, complaining about teachers, as every middle school student does ever. It's not, you know, if you're a teacher, it's not you personally. They complain about everybody. But the problem was the teacher had taken points off of her for her notebooks. They were doing a notebook grade because the notebook wasn't a binder and it was written in pen and not pencil.
Right.
And, you know, in my head, I'm thinking, like, who cares if your notes are in pen and pencil?
Right.
You know? So, like, there's a lot of struggling with this with education, and it looks so different across the board from teacher to teacher, that, you know, they're not going to just assume that you can do whatever. You know, like my son said, yeah, the first week in class, my teacher said, if it's after 3 days, I can't turn it in. So why 6 months now would I even ask on the fifth day if I can turn it in? Because that's the type of person he is.
And he's got a point.
Right. You know, because that's what the teacher says. And now I'm not knocking that. I want to say old school mentality, but I was thinking about calculators yesterday.
Yeah.
And what that means in a math classroom. And then I was thinking about my own math research and the things I do. And I don't do anything by hand. I have statistical programming software called R that I program in. I write some things in Python. I mean, I let the computer do the computer work, and I do the creative aspect of the thing. I'm not multiplying matrices by hand. I'm not, you know, looking at linear relationships and doing all that modeling by hand. I'm throwing it into the tools that I have so I can be different.
Right.
We still have that mindset. Like, there's math teachers who are completely against calculators, and I get it for some things, but we're not a manufacturing age anymore.
Right.
We don't have to have 10,000 widgets out every Friday.
Yeah.
Bots for that now.
Yeah.
The robots do the assembly line and get the widgets out. We create the widgets. So why are we teaching our students to be the robot instead of the creative guy creating the widget?
To make this a little meta, I guess, of a conversation, is the question becomes, do we have the growth mindset with teaching?
Right.
Are we able to transform our teaching to match this generation of kids who they don't need information. All their information they have on a small pocket computer, and they can ask it anything. They don't need to memorize information. They need to use something else.
I mean, and not to poke at your discipline, but doesn't Google Translate pretty much put you out of a job?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I actually do have a defense on that one. So just to make it even more scary is they now have earpieces that you can put in your ear and set it to the language you're listening to. And so you have two earpieces, one goes in one person's ear, the other one goes in the other, and you speak, and the earpiece translates it on the spot and speaks it to the person.
Right.
And it's terrifying because, yeah, eventually the computer is going to get good enough that people don't really need to speak each other's language. But the problem is then what you're doing is you are giving the option of translation to a machine that will choose one outcome. So when you're translating a language from one language to another, if I'm trying to communicate an emotion or an idea in Spanish, I've got multiple phrases at my disposal that I get to use that are very unique to Spanish, and because I'm fluent in the language. So being fluent in the language isn't just being fluent in the language, it's being fluent in the culture, and it's also being fluent in the I guess, for lack of a better term, like the quirks of a language.
Yeah.
And that's something a machine just isn't going to have. I imagine it'll get close. Like Google Translate is amazing.
Artificial intelligence getting there. I mean,
yeah, but what you're doing is you are surrendering the option to be able to choose your own translation of something. If that makes sense.
Well, let me tell you the two good things about it.
Yeah.
The first thing that's good is the education system will take forever to catch up. Like, I still think we're teaching cursive writing in school somewhere, right? I haven't, like, nobody's written English calligraphy in forever, but there's still elementary schools that are making people learn cursive handwriting.
Right.
And the second thing is just get a degree in administration, and as soon as your field becomes outdated in 30 years, you're now a principal and you don't have to worry about it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, I'm not concerned with language because language, if it's again, it's the information versus what's the next stage, which is creativity.
Right.
So if the information ever gets to a point where learning a language is obsolete, cultural awareness will never be obsolete.
Sure.
Like that, and honestly, that's the end goal. The end goal of learning a language is to learn how to relate to another culture. And so that piece of it is something a machine can never take the place of, is learning how to relate to another culture and learning, you know, how to act and the amazing features of that culture. That's something I'll always get to teach. And honestly, that's the fun part. Like, I love teaching Spanish. But I get so happy when the students get past the point of learning how to conjugate verbs to the point where they can actually say a sentence in Spanish, and we can move on past the grammar and actually into the culture.
And you can go to Mexican restaurants during your lunch break.
Right. Hey, I never want to stop teaching Spanish because it gives me an excuse to travel.
It does. Like that, the field trips.
Yeah.
When you're a foreign language teacher, are just the best, you know, because you could go to cultural fairs, you can go to other countries, you can take six students in your personal car for an hour at lunch to La Hacienda, and eat burritos and tacos.
And I may or may not have done that last semester.
Right. Or La Tortilleria.
Right.
Because
yeah.
That place is amazing.
Hey, the Mexican popsicle store is coming up in the next couple of weeks, so that'll be good.
Wow.
Yeah, so everybody out there, don't be a math teacher. Be a Spanish teacher.
Or just go with the Spanish teacher as a chaperone to all of their field trips.
There you go. Okay, so I guess one last question to tackle is, how do we teach students to have a growth mindset?
There's a lot of resources online, and I'll try to put some on my website that I'm creating, because it's not easy, because this whole education system, I never want to say it's broken. A lot of it's outdated, and a lot of teachers, and this is going to offend people, I'm sorry, a lot of teachers are stupid. You know, I've met a lot of teachers that shouldn't be in the profession, should have left a long time ago. And there's a lot of educators who are brilliant. Like, there's a lot of people out there who really belong in education. But yeah, we're always going to be fighting the old, this is how we've always done it. And it really comes to, you know, educating students and just making your classroom different. And it's hard. This past school year, yeah, and I taught them how to, I told them to focus on learning instead of grades. And even that was hard, yeah, because everybody's like, oh, I got an 85. What can I do to add 5 points to the grade? Give me an extra assignment. Give me some. It's not that they don't want to work hard. They're just working hard for the wrong reason. And I tell them they can retake any test they want.
Yeah.
And that's not, sometimes that doesn't even register. Like, you know, it's like, you mean I could take it again? I'm like, well, yeah.
Yeah.
And again, like, yeah, like you, I want you to learn the material. And so we just need to create these environments in our classroom where it's learning, and it's not about whether you're smart or not smart. It's about making the mistakes, learning the material, having fun, growing,
yeah,
you know, not to get stuck where you are. And because I tell everybody, and I'll price this a billion times in the podcast, it's grades will get you to college, but the knowledge keeps,
yeah,
you there. You know, you could have a 3.9 and be the most person has the least knowledge I've ever met, or you could have a 2.8 and have learned everything and, you know, really understand the concepts. It's not about, it is because the grades are a system we play and it need to get you in college, but you're not going to make it through college if you don't learn the material. And honestly, if you really learn the material and focus on learning, the grades,
yeah,
follow. You know, if you can't know all the material and fail the class, unless your teacher just cares whether you write in pen or pencil,
right,
or if that pen blue or pink, you know, like I opened up one of my students to writing in pink pen, and it was the happiest day of her life because she's like, every other teacher told me I can't write in this pen. I'm like, I don't care what color your pen is. You know, if we're going to pick fights in the classroom, it's not going to be because you're taking notes in,
right,
pink.
Yeah.
You know, those are the things I care. And I know it's old, it's a tradition, but I don't care if they wear hats in my,
yeah,
classroom. You know, like, what do I care if you have a cap on your head? Like, I want you to learn math. I don't care if you're wearing a hoodie or a hat or, you know, a tank top or flip flops or, like, you know, wear deodorant. That's important to me.
Yeah. And I agree. We got to pick our battles. And the one thing that I would suggest too, as far as teaching, getting students to, you know, to a growth mindset, is let them know about the growth mindset. Let them know,
right,
hey, your brain's going to adapt to this. Your brain is amazingly adaptable. And because a lot of students don't think it's possible. They think, oh,
right,
I have this fixed IQ. I'm, you know, got my learning accommodations. And I'm always going to need these. And
right,
no, you might not if you know that you can, your brain is going to change. And a lot of that has to do with how you interpret your falls, your failures. So,
right,
yeah. So I would say students need to know about this information, and they need to know that their brain can change. And again, the resources I've read is a book called Peak, and I'll put that on my website. My website is profepablo.com. And I haven't read the book yet, but I've read a lot of her research. There's a book out called Grit by Angela Duckworth, and it's about the growth mindset.
And Joe Bowler out of Stanford, she's from the United Kingdom. She's a professor in Stanford in the mathematics department. Her focus is math education. She has a lot of good resources on growth mindset. And there's somebody in the department of psychiatry. I can't remember her last name, but you can get linked there through Dr. Bowler's site. And there's a lot of good resources.
Awesome. So speaking of sites, how's your site coming?
So my blog, Whiteboards and Wizardry, has officially begun. Nice. I'm just about everywhere on social media. Like my Twitter's starting to become active again. I'm getting a Tumblr going. I have Instagram, WordPress to host my blog. My website is wbawy.com.
And what is that? That stands for Whiteboards and Wizardry.
Whiteboards and Wizardry, exactly. Cool. And so you can now email me if you have complaints at daniel@wbawy.com.
Oh, finally.
So it's not all about – the good thing is that we don't have listeners, so I feel like I get the short end of the stick. Like the first three or four podcasts here, you know, Prophase, like, yeah, if you guys have complaints, please email me. And there's nobody listening to these first three podcasts right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I haven't gotten any
So he's
complaints.
Not getting any complaints.
We have one listener who listened to episode two, so that's good.
Oh, nice. And they haven't complained yet.
They haven't complained.
So here we are.
I blog at profepablo.com. That's profepablo.com. And you can reach me at paul@profepablo.com. My social media is not very active right now, but I'm getting ready to redo a bunch of stuff in the next couple of weeks. So cool. Well, until next time, happy teaching, and yeah, we'll see you guys later.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.